Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am your host for today, Shatranjay Mall. Today I'm speaking with Professor Viren Murthy about his new book, The Politics of Time in China and Japan, Back to the Future, which was published by Routledge in 2022. Professor Murthy is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a transnational historian of Asia, and his research focuses on Chinese, Japanese, and Indian intellectual history. His particular areas of study concern critiques of capitalism and modernity, and he's also interested in post-colonialism and Marxism. So thank you for joining the podcast today, Viren.
Thank you for having me.
I'm looking forward to talking to you today. So our first question is always biographical. So I would like to ask you about your background. Where did you grow up? And how did you become a transnational historian of East Asia?
Okay. That's a somewhat of a long story, but I'll try to keep it short. So I was born in Chicago, but we returned to India, specifically Bombay. It was about Bombay back then. When I was about 2 weeks old, and we returned then to Chicago when I was about five, returned to India around when I was 10, and then with some other kind of backs and forth, moved back to Chicago more or less permanently when I was around 16 or so. I was moving back and forth between these two places and cultures. And I guess the next question then, I guess, is how I became a transnational historian. Well, I started out actually with an interest in China, specifically not really history as much as philosophy. But then as I sort of developed, I began to become interested in looking at philosophy and history together. And that's sort of what we call intellectual history, history of philosophy, and so on. Now, how at that point, I wasn't really transnational. I mean, my original interest was actually in ancient China. And so the question of any national, whether it be transnational or even national, doesn't really make sense at that level. But one of the things that maybe pushed me in a more transnational direction was that as part of the training for learning about China, one often learns Japanese. And so as I was learning Japanese, I began to become interested in Japanese intellectual history. And then as I noticed a lot of the interaction between these two cultures, especially a lot of Chinese intellectuals going to Japan and so on, I began to bring these two together. And then I guess I did my PhD dissertation on a Chinese revolutionary named Jiang Taiyuan. And he went to Tokyo, when he was escaping from the Manchu government in the early 20th century, I think around 1906. And he also had an interest in Buddhism, which he associated with India. So in this one figure, I sort of had these three cultures that I was interested in, these three histories that I was interested in, I guess, China, Japan, and India. And so then slowly, I guess that's how I became something like a transnational or maybe comparative historian at times. I mean, my work is not always transnational, but sometimes often thought of in terms of comparison with other countries, including, of course, European countries.
Thank you for sharing that. I would now like to turn to talking about your new book, the book we're talking about today. So The Politics of Time in China and Japan, Back to the Future, is a deeply fascinating and engaging work of intellectual history with an eye-catching title. So how do you come to write this book, and what do you see as its major arguments and contributions? And related to that, could you tell us a little bit about the title and subtitle of the book?
Yes, thank you for that question. It actually touches on a number of different issues. I guess the first thing I should say is, with respect to the book and the various parts, is I hope that in this case of the book, the whole is more than the sum of its various parts, because it's a book of various essays that were actually first written separately, many of them. And then Robert Langham at Rutledge asked me if I wanted to publish some essays together. And then as I looked at these essays, I felt that they all revolved around this question of the politics of time in China and Japan. And what I mean by the politics of time is really connected to this idea of retrieving the past or tradition for a politics of a different future. Now, usually one thinks of a politics of tradition as something connected to conservatism, right? But, you know, in the sense that these are people who are maybe critical of modernity or something and they want to go back. But in the case of my book, we're looking at a lot of people who draw on the past in order to further certain goals that are often associated with the left, such as the critique of capitalism. And so for this reason, I called the book Back to the Future, because in some sense, they're going back to the past, but what they're really interested in is the future. Now, of course, they're both right-wing and left-wing critics of capitalism. And one of the things I was sort of interested in is trying to see, you know, how those might relate in some way or the other. But a lot of the figures that are in the book are in some ways connected to Marxism. And so that's what sort of shows the way in which you can find this kind of politics of tradition on the left as well as the right.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. When I was reading the book, I was sort of very struck by the various examples of the various figures that you talk about, and about, you know, this theme of like using tradition to sort of mobilize for the future and sort of to critique the present in a way. So I'll turn to talking about the book in more detail in just a moment. But before that, I wanted to ask you about your research and writing for the book. So how did you go about researching for and writing this book, and what were your main sources? As you mentioned, that these were like, some of them were like standalone essays, so you might have done like the research and writing for them at various points of time, but could you just tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, and here I'll have to sort of begin with a caveat, and I hope I will not disappoint you, because I guess as an intellectual historian, especially a historian of philosophy, I don't have as many stories as perhaps other historians would about like the complexities of archival research, to the extent that many of my sources are published, you know, because they're often books, they're texts that may have been reissued. You know, in the case of Jiang Taiyan, maybe there'll be like magazines such as, you know, the Minbao, the Revolutionary Journal. But even those, many of those you can find in his complete collected works and so on. The way in which I got a lot of these essays is in my various trips to China and Japan. And, you know, and I would, you know, go to various bookstores, maybe a lot of used bookstores, those kind of things, sometimes libraries and so on. I guess that's all I can say about the sources. But, and with respect to the writing, as I said, and as you also mentioned, it happened over a number of years. Maybe around 10 years at least. And, you know, they were often for different venues where I began, you know, I'd start out being interested in various different topics connected to, you know, maybe a conference on modernity or something like that. And then I noticed that throughout all of these, there was this one theme that was constantly emerging, right? And I guess I thought, well, what do I contribute to this theme? And I guess it is really bringing this problem of the politics of tradition together with the problem of capitalism, I guess, is really what I'm trying to constantly bring back in some way or the other in each of these essays.
Thank you. So now I will turn to sequentially asking you about the chapters of the book. So the introduction of the book discusses some of the theoretical problems related to the politics of time as discussed by various theorists. So as we discussed, like one of the issues is like the issues related to mobilizing the past to open up the way for a different future. So you discuss the contrast between Moish Postone and Harry Harrington's theorizations of the politics of time and present your own theoretical framework drawing on their work. So for those of our listeners not familiar with this topic, could you tell us a little more about these theorists as well as these various theories related to the politics of time?
Sure. That's a very long question, and it really gets to, I think, the heart of the book. So for many years, I've been interested in the problem of, you know, Marxism and the politics of time. And I believe that the two scholars that you mentioned, Moish Postone and Harry Harrington, I think their respective theorization of the politics of time really present two major strands within not only Marxism, but more broadly. So let's begin with Moish Postone. He's a social theorist who actually I think passed away just a couple of years ago. And his position is complicated because he contends that capitalism should be understood as a totality that sort of encompasses everything. There's very much the idea that there isn't really, once capitalism really gets fully constructed, the dynamic, once it gets established, there isn't really an outside that is very significant. And so once he does that, he says that there are certain structures that emerge in capitalism. One of the main structures is the commodity form, right? And the commodity form, for those of our listeners who haven't read Marx, I mean, it's really outlined in the first chapter of Capital, where you have an opposition between use value and exchange value, where use value represents the concrete side of the commodity form and exchange value represents the abstract, right? So that, for example, the price of a commodity is the abstract and exchange value side, right? Because the price can be like $10 regardless of what object you're talking about. But the use value is extremely concrete. Now, at the face of it, this would seem to have, you know, it sounds like something that's in economics or sociology or something, but, you know, what does it have to do with thought or intellectual history? And I think what Postone tries to do, now here he's drawing on a lot of people like the Frankfurt School, but he wants to say that the opposition between something like concrete and abstract more generally is grounded in the commodity form. Now, this then connects us to the politics of the past, because in Postone's view, those scholars who try to use recourse to the tradition to resist, you know, the abstractions of modernity, they are actually, without knowing it, just reproducing the logic of the commodity form, right? And so his argument is that such people do not understand the object of their critique, namely capitalism. And so as a consequence, they're sort of overcome by that logic or just reproduce that logic. Now, he gives an example of this, and he's written about, say, Nazi Germany, where Nazi Germany, you had all these anti-capitalists who were looking at the peasant, all these kind of things that seemed to be sort of outside of capital. But what they when they actually mobilize that, they end up reproducing a fascist form of capitalism. So that, I guess, is going to be the Postone in a nutshell. There's obviously a lot more to say, and I've written about him in other places. Now, Harry Harutunian is an interesting figure because he's actually starts out as a historian of Japan, but he's a historian of Japan who, you know, has, I think, really contributed to the field in bringing theory to Japanese studies in many ways. He wrote a book in 2000 that was actually a study of, it's a book called Overcome by Modernity, with a very nice title, which really dealt with a lot of the Kyoto school and somewhat conservative thinkers in Japan and in the interwar period. And his main argument, when I first read it, I actually thought it was very Postonian, because if you think about it, the argument is that he says that all these people are trying to overcome modernity, but what they actually do is become overcome by modernity, right? Because so the argument in that sense overlaps with Postone. However, even in that book, he's quite interested in the problem of uneven development and multiple temporalities, which he doesn't really, you know, the significance of that doesn't come out in his Overcome by Modernity, but it comes out in a book published in, I think, around 2015 called Marx Beyond Marx. And there he begins to look at Marxists, and not just in Japan, but there is a Japanese Marxist he deals with in some detail, Uno Kozo. But he looks at, you know, Chinese Marxists, I think Wang Yanan he looks at a number of other scholars who are in some sense Marxists, but who are somewhat interested in uneven development. And, you know, so you can think something like third world Marxism. And there he says that with this problem of multiple temporalities, some of the temporalities that are not completely subsumed under capitalism, so certain modes of life and so on, could be used to resist capitalism. So now you get the idea of, you know, this idea of a politics of tradition in Marxism, you know, that can't be reducible to a fascist outcome. Now, this is again connected to another argument that he makes about real and formal subsumption that I'll quickly articulate. Now, put simply, the idea of real subsumption, the way he interprets it, is that everything gets subsumed under capitalism, while the idea of formal subsumption is that capitalism, and this is the standard reading, is in the beginning of capitalism, capital first formally subsumes, so it leaves other modes of production intact without completely transforming them. Now, there's a debate within Marxism as to whether that's a stage, like first you subsume without completely transforming the mode, but eventually the mode gets transformed and you have capitalism. Now, what Harutunian wants to say, no, what one has to see is that capitalism always remains somewhat incomplete. It's never able to completely subsume its other. And then that other can be a fulcrum of resistance, right? I think that's, I realize that was a lot, but...
Thank you for sharing that. I mean, I think that it's what you share, the sort of the issues that you discuss related to both Postone and Harutunian, like these sort of touch on so many different issues. So I'd urge any of our listeners who are interested in sort of thinking more about this to read the introduction to the book in which you articulate some of this. So now I'll turn to talking about the rest of the chapter. So in chapter one, you examine shifting conceptions of the Chinese past by Chinese and Japanese intellectuals over time as East Asia shifted from a Sino-centric world to the modern world of nation states. So could you tell us more about these changing Chinese and Japanese perspectives and about some of the thinkers that you analyzed to elucidate these transformations as well as differences among these various viewpoints?
Yeah, so chapter one was is a very broad chapter. I mean, I it's not something usually that I think a historian would write, because I start with Confucius and I get all the way to the 20th century. So, but the reason I chose Confucius is because I began to think about, you know, if you think about a politics of the past, I mean, Confucius was perhaps one of the first people who talked about, you know, the politics of the past, because his whole idea of, you know, going, you know, he's writing in the Warring States period, right? So, he's seeing his society as being very chaotic. And he says, well, there's a past, you know, where the three dynasties, you know, which is, you know, something like 1200 BC, right? He's writing around what, something like 6th century or something. I mean, I think, you know, and he's saying, you know, if we could go back to that past, things would be much better. That's when the rituals, the society was well ordered. So I look at Confucius as one of the first people who really deals with this politics of time, because he's going back to that past, but, you know, later Confucians will say, you know, in some sense, he's like a reformer using that past. And so I look at that and then show how, you know, that idea continues in China, but eventually, you know, you get versions of that in Japan as well, right? So moving to Japan very quickly, one of the figures I look at is Ogyu Sorai, right? And so he's an Edo period, a Tokugawa period, right? Tokugawa meaning what? I think specifically he's actually 17th century. And he's someone who goes back to Confucius, but, you know, in a Japanese context. And he's doing that to sort of attack, like, the Tokugawa, in some sense, ideology of the Sung Confucians, right? So, I mean, to understand this, I guess one needs to know a little bit about the history of Confucianism in China, where you start with classical Confucianism, but one of the big breaks that happens is Sung Dynasty Confucianism. Where you really get the establishment of very new, much more abstract concepts like the heavenly principle, right? Which is a concept that is foreign to classical Confucius. So you get something that is much more metaphysical, right? Because by the time you get to the Sung, you know, the real going back to the three dynasties is impossible. So what you have to do is keep the three dynasties as an ideal, but then still use this metaphysical principle to somehow say that, you know, what the three dynasties mean for us is actually embodied in the Sung Dynasty state or something like that, right? Now, the Tokugawa, right, the regime eventually uses a lot of these ideas because they're trying to naturalize their own kind of power. And that power is, in some sense, going to be ideologically buttressed through, you know, an amalgam of, you know, Shinto and Song Confucianism. So this idea of, especially the idea of the heavenly principle. And it's interesting that in the context, you know, of the 17th century, Ogyu Sorai then comes in and says, hey, you know, this is all going in the wrong direction. And so then China, it's not only the past, but also there's a geographical dissimilarity here, right? Because China comes up almost as a symbol of critique. And so much so that China as the past, or China as, you know, another geographical entity, becomes almost subordinate to this figure of China as an idea, right? And I say this because, you know, there are parts where Ogyu Sorai sometimes says, you know, Japan actually is realizing Chinese ideals better than China, right? In certain ways, right? And so I move on to that that figure and his use of China, and that, but then I move on from there to Motoori Norinaga, right, who's little later than Ogyu Sorai, and, you know, he has a very structurally very similar argument, except China sort of takes a completely different valence in his work, right? Because he's also saying we need to go back, but instead of going back to the Japanese past, he says we'd have to go back to the Chinese past. And so, instead of going back to the Chinese past, he says we need to go back to the Japanese past. And so that's, you know, some people see that as being very significant because it's like a proto-nationalism or something that emerges, you know, before Western contact, right? And then I move from there to, you know, Meiji Restoration, and then a complete shift where with someone like Fukuzawa Yukichi writing after, you know, the Meiji Restoration, I think it's in the 1870s, he has this famous Bunmeiron no Gairaku, right? The an inquiry or outline of a theory of civilization, where he actually outlines a very linear idea of civilization, which is progressive, right? So that's what I began, I end the chapter with, that you move from this politics of going back to the future to kind of Fukuzawa Yukichi, where you're moving forward. Although I said, what I also show is that he can't quite completely separate himself from the politics of the past, because the nation state is in some sense always in a tension between these two, because on the one hand it's going forward, but the idea of constructing a national identity always requires you to go back to the past, and so the emperor and these kind of things also require this gesture to the past. And then finally, the last figure in the chapter is Jiang Taiyuan, who does a critique of evolutionary time. So I end with that in his use of Buddhism.
Thank you. That's absolutely fascinating. And I think it sort of is something that would sort of interest like people from many different disciplines, like not just history, but like philosophy and so on. Since you discussed like Confucius and some of these other figures. And actually, as you were speaking, I also just suddenly had a follow-up question about like notions of time. And, could you, like you mentioned that Fukuzawa Yukichi takes this linear conception of time. Could you tell us a little more about shifting conceptions of time in East Asia in the sense that, you know, was there some sort of shift from thinking of time in a circular sense to thinking of time in a linear sense?
Yeah, I mean, you could put it that way. I think they're always, we have to be careful not to be too binary in all of these, in these judgments, but we could say maybe there's a dominant mode. For example, Confucian time, there's something cyclical about it, right? I mean, because if we think about dynastic time, it is cyclical in the sense that, you know, you get one dynasty ending and then you get another dynasty that has to now redo the calendars and all of these kind of things. So there's something cyclical about it. But there is also the idea of, if you want to think about their idea of keeping the three dynasties as an ideal, there's still an idea of a kind of history as regression that keeps coming up, right? That, you know, that was the golden age and things are getting worse and worse and we've got to figure out how do we get back, right? How do we at least bring that spirit back, if not bring the institutions back? I think in Confucius's time, there was actually the idea that we could bring the institutions back. By the Song, you can't do that. But there was still the idea that we could bring the spirit back. Now, I think that's what changes, that all of a sudden the goal is the future. This idea of development and progress is really what's, I think, central to modern conceptions of time, that, you know, things are getting better and better, right? And that kind of thing is very, so that all of a sudden the past in some ways looks like it's something we need to overcome. But that's precisely what makes me interested in these Back to the Future narratives, because those are people saying, no, there's something in the past that really is not just of the past, but, you know, could be part of our future, right? And I think that's what animates much of the book. But one last thing about that, I mean, is, you know, the reason I say we have to be careful about this idea of thinking about linear and circular, I mean, because someone like, you know, around the Song Dynasty, there was certain ideas, you know, it's a late Tang thinker named Liu Zongyuan has this idea of, you know, the propensity of time or something like that, right? This idea of shi. That actually is sort of moving in a, he wants to say that it's there's a way in which it's there's a move forward where you can't go completely backwards, right? And so that is a kind of linear time. And the reason he says that is he wants to say we can't go back to the older Zhou dynasty system, which was much more decentralized. So there is, you know, it's not a simple idea of progress, but it is this idea of sort of, you know, we can't go back, right? That kind of idea.
Thank you. So now I'll turn to talking about chapter two. You discuss various post-Hegelian critics of modernity in Germany and Japan in the early 20th century in chapter two. So I have a two-part question related to this chapter. So firstly, for those in our audience not as familiar with Hegel, could you tell us about the Hegelian vision of history? And then secondly, could you tell us about the various Japanese and German intellectuals and the critiques of modernity that they present that you discuss in this chapter?
Right. So Hegel is complex. But for this chapter, it's not so much Hegel himself who's going to be the main figure, but how Hegel was perceived. Because I don't think Hegel was a simple linear theorist of time. There are all these ways in which he wanted to really synthesize some of the benefits of the ancient world, especially the Greek world, with the modern period. But I think the way he's eventually perceived is very much as a theorist of progress and linear history. And so that's really the kind of foil that articulates this chapter, right? That he is the figure who a lot of people in the 20th century start criticizing. And I was noticing that a lot of people are criticizing this vision of progress, because in some sense we just talked about that vision of progress in the first chapter. And I began to see these other people who all try to find something that can resist this, right? So that I'm looking at, you know, a couple of figures from different perspectives. And I think one is Franz Rosenzweig, who is a Jewish philosopher. And I look at him and the way in which he wants to say there's something about the Jewish experience that doesn't quite fit this linear history, right? Because so that the linear history he wants to say is almost maybe there's something very Christian about it, right? And he wants to say there's another type of time in Jewish practices and so on. And that is something, and here I draw on the work of Mikhail Levy, you know, where he says that a lot of these Jewish leftists were drawing on this idea of, you know, some kind of Jewish experience, you know, idea of a different type of time to construct their idea of socialism. Or a critique of capitalism, and so in that sense, I was drawing on that, and then I wanted to see whether, you know, I argue that in Japan also you have some similar kind of figures. I think I specifically look at Miki Kiyoshi, an interwar Japanese sort of Marxist, but he's someone who's sort of really spans. He goes from being a Marxist to being somewhat more on the right, but I think despite his criticism, despite his shift, he's always interested in drawing on the past to criticize capitalism. And I specifically look at his reading of Shinran, the Kamakura medieval Japanese Buddhist, who, you know, has this almost a kind of millennial kind of vision of decline and so on, and the Buddhist law and all of these kind of things. And I show how he draws on that to articulate a critique of his contemporary society that is becoming worse and worse and increasing in various types of oppressions. Did that answer the question?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, that you're not just a transnational historian, but a comparative historian. And the examples you draw in this chapter of Germany and Japan sort of illustrate that sort of perspective that you bring in the book. In the third chapter, you recover the Japanese Marxist philosopher Umemoto Katsumi, who you argue is overlooked in the history of Japanese philosophy. And indeed, much of our audience may not be familiar with this figure either. So could you tell us a little more about him and why you see him as a significant figure in Japanese intellectual history?
Yeah, so he is an overlooked figure because, I mean, when you think about, like, when people talk about Japanese philosophy, they'll even most probably talk about the Kyoto school and so on, philosophers such as Nishida Kitaro and so on, maybe Miki Kiyoshi, although he's sort of in the margins of that that school, but definitely Nishida Kitaro, Tanabe, Hajime would be two people that'll come to mind. And usually Marxists in general are not really discussed. Recently, maybe there's some interest in Tosaka Jun. But Umemoto Katsumi is not really discussed that much. But Umemoto, I think he became most famous for this the debate about subjectivity in the 50s, in the post-war period. The big debate was about, you know, what is the role of subjectivity in Marxism? And I sort of pick up on that. And I get into a dialogue with some of the few other works on Umemoto Katsumi in English, and that is basically, I guess, with Victor Koshman's book is the most well known there, right? Revolution and Subjectivity, and I began to look at, well, what was really Umemoto's politics, and I think that Koshman and others say, well, you know, he didn't stress subjectivity enough, and so on, and this kind of thing, and I try to show how, you know, by drawing on an amalgam of people like, you know, he draws on, you know, Buddhist ideas. I mean, he was also someone very early on influenced by Shinran, the Pure Land Buddhism, but also people like Heidegger and so on. So the 20th century kind of anti-Hegelian kind of perspectives. But what I want to show is that what he tries to do insofar as he remains Marxist is to take some of those Heideggerian elements, you know, this, you know, ideas such as nothingness, all this, because that's what sort of gives human beings possibilities, you know, that's moment of subjectivity. But he tries to reinscribe that whole moment of subjectivity in a larger historical narrative towards socialism, right? And so that's what I think the project is. And so in some sense, there's a re-Hegelianizing that he tries to develop at the end there, because he doesn't want the subjectivity to just merely be indeterminate, but somehow bring these things together, you know, including ideas such as class struggle. So if we put Umemoto Katsumi back into that, his own context, he was criticized quite severely by the more orthodox Marxists, because they were saying, you know, there's no reason for subjectivity. Why should Marxists be talking about subjectivity? We should just be talking about class, right? And he says, no. We need both, right? And that I think is what I was looking at. I mean, towards the end, I also have a discussion of the whole problem of civil society and so on. But
So in chapter 4, you discuss two Japanese sinologists, Nishi Junzo and Mizoguchi Yuzo, who were both influenced by the sinologist and Pan-Asianist Takeuchi Yoshimi. So could you tell us more about these figures and their visions of the Chinese Communist Revolution of 1949, as well as the concept of Tianxia?
Okay, so these two figures are sort of interesting because they're often not written about. I think in the other, I mean, even less than the other figures that I talk about, because, you know, Nishi Junzo is someone who, if you're not a China scholar, especially someone interested in Chinese intellectual history, you may not even know this person. But he's an interesting figure because his father was actually a contemporary of Nishida Kitaro, and was also an ethicist, a somewhat conservative. And Nishi Junzo sort of grows up being very influenced by some of that background. So ethical thought, but also very German. He studied a lot of German thought. And then from that perspective, he then becomes a sinologist. And so he sort of brings these two things together. And in the post-war period, he also starts becoming very interested in Mao Zedong and sort of Maoist thought and the Chinese Revolution. But he starts bringing this, you know, sensitivity with sort of German thought, especially German idealism, to his reading of the Chinese Revolution. And one of the paradigms and one of the processes that he described is somewhat, I guess, indebted to Takeuchi Yoshimi, or at least overlaps with Takeuchi Yoshimi. And that is that he claims that what happens in China is that as the whole modernization project constantly fails, right? So, for example, the self-strengthening movement, the 100 days reform, the 1911 revolution, even none of them really succeed, right? And so what he says is by that time, what happens is China is reduced to almost nothing, right? But then it's that nothing that then resists, right? So he gets that almost a kind of dialectical reversal. And that when that nothingness resists, and he thinks in some sense Jiang Taiyuan embodies a lot of this, when that nothingness resists, and actually, which in some sense represents the people, right? I mean, because the people are those who have nothing. You can also think about it, you know, Musen Xia is actually, could also almost be synonymous with the kind of proletariat. But in any case, that the outcome of that is the 1949 revolution. So what's interesting about this is that it is a dialectical movement, but it's one that doesn't really depend that much on the tradition, right? Because it's actually about when everything is reduced to nothing, well, then you have that resistance. So I contrast that with Mizoguchi Yuzo, because Mizoguchi Yuzo is another one he's also got some interest in this kind of dialectics and so on. But what he tries to do, again, somewhat influenced by Takeuchi Yoshimi, because he's the one who started this idea of China taking this other path and so on. But what Mizoguchi Yuzo does that's very different is instead of saying, well, China is reduced to nothing, in fact, he's very critical of that because he says that overlooks all of what happens in Chinese history. And in fact, he criticizes both Nishi Junzo and Takeuchi Yoshimi for saying that, you know, the China that you've constructed to understand the revolution is actually just a mirror of Japan, that these scholars are much more interested in criticizing Japan than they are in actually understanding China, right? So that it becomes this kind of fiction. And so what he says is you have to go back to the past of China, and he starts trying to find a logic to the Chinese past. So what he does with that, and I think, you know, this is a figure who I think really deserves more work, because what he does is he starts looking at the history of Chinese thought and the emergence of subjectivity in China. So this is the attempt to sort of find indigenous modernity in China. And once he does that, he then says, well, in the Ming and the late Qing, you begin to get the emergence of this subjectivity, but it's a very different type of subjectivity because it's always already mediated by some kind of communal impulse. And that's what really animates the Chinese Revolution. And all of this is then connected to this problem of Tianxia, because Tianxia is, in some sense, you know, literally meaning all under heaven. Now, in the Nishi Junzo case, the Tianxia is the nothingness, where it's the people, right, that become the goal. And it also can explain why something like socialism becomes a global kind of goal, right, for the Chinese. Now, for Mizoguchi Yuzo, the Tianxia is actually embodied in this kind of dialectic between the kind of individual subjectivity and the community. I guess the communal moment is the Tianxia moment. So that the Tian, which is heaven, is always a kind of, there's always a communal kind of dimension to it for Mizoguchi Yuzo. But he says that within that, you begin to see the emergence of subjectivity, which people have overlooked because they're all so busy trying to sort of say that, you know, the pre-modern has to be negated. And he wants to say, no, it's actually in the transformations of the pre-modern that we can understand the particular form that modernity takes in China.
Thank you. I mean, I think, as you mentioned, like these are very overlooked figures. And I think one of the major contributions of your book through like the earlier chapter on Umemoto Katsumi, as well as this chapter on Nishi Junzo, Mizuguchi Yuzo, and so on, is that figures who historians of China and Japan may not be as familiar with, they might be able to sort of get to know more about them from reading your book. And as you mentioned, like they deserve further work, like Mizoguchi Yuzo or Nishi Junzo. So I hope other scholars sort of build on what you've written in this book to open up new paths for scholarship after this. So in chapter 5, which is the final chapter of the book, you put Marxism and traditional Chinese philosophy in conversation and approach this dialogue through the work of the contemporary Chinese philosopher Zhao Tingyang, who has theorized Tianxia or All Under Heaven. So firstly, for those in our audience who are unfamiliar with Zhao, could you tell us a little bit more about him and his work? And secondly, how does connecting Tianxia with Marxism provide a roadmap for an alternative post-capitalist global order?
Yeah, so this chapter continues a theme that I introduced in the previous, and that is the problem of Tianxia. But now I'm looking at a contemporary figure, right? So Zhao Tingyang, who's actually contemporary, I think he's born in maybe in 1963 or something like that. And he's one of the most famous Chinese philosophers writing today. I think his work has been translated in a number of Western languages, including French, German, and English. His the title of the chapter suggests, I mean, his main idea is Tianxia. In fact, there's an essay that's a book that's, I think, recently just been translated into English, I think called The Tianxia System or something like that. He tries to say, well, the big thing about the difference and the real contribution of Chinese philosophy is this concept of Tianxia, that if you think about governance, the West takes the idea of the nation state as its model. But China has always taken the whole world as a model, right? And at least in traditional China. And we need to go back to that. And he says, why do we need to go back to that? Well, take a look at many of these global crises. Think about the pandemic, for example, right? The pandemic is a transnational problem. But the only main ways we have to deal with it are national. And he says, then, of course, you're going to have all kinds of problems. The nation state is ill-equipped to deal with this problem. We need a transnational solution. But that's not the only one. That's just one of the recent ones. I mean, think about things like global poverty, the environmental crisis. I mean, one could go on and on. That all of these problems are things that need global solutions and global institutions. And so he says we need to go back to, you know, try to find some kind of larger spheres of institutional cooperation. And that's what he thinks the Tianxia really deals with. Now, I think to come to your second question about Marxism and the post-capitalist global order, I think that although Zhao Tingyang doesn't maybe put capitalism at the center, I do try to point in ways in which he does sort of at least allude to that problem. Although he doesn't put it at the center, I think the problem of capitalism is everywhere here, right? Because if you think about any of these issues, like whether environmental, poverty, or any of these issues, in some way or the other, they're all connected to the problem of capitalism. And the one place where we do have global institutions are often to enable capitalist production and capital flows, right? I mean, think about, you know, World Bank, all of these kind of things, IMF. I mean, these are all institutions that in some way or the other facilitate the reproduction of capitalism. But what we don't have is are institutions to sort of maybe curb and transform capitalism. And I think that's what the Marxist project and the Tianxia project could actually have in common. Now, the question, of course, is what? How do we get from here to there? And that, I think, is the big problem. I think one of the things that Zhao Tingyang actually says is that we do have low-level globalization today, right? I mean, but we don't have a reflexive globalization, because what happens now is that we have things that are global, but things are just going in all kinds of chaotic directions, you know, so that we're affected by all this global, you know, downturns in the economy and so on. What happens in one country can affect the rest of the world. But we don't have institutions for collective global governance. And I think that's what where he's gesturing towards.
Thank you. So I think my last question before we end the podcast is about the conclusion of the book. So you bring attention to the contradictions and polarized views of China's rise in the conclusion. So could you share some final thoughts on this topic as it relates to your book and the politics of time? It's sort of, I guess, sort of, it's also connected with what you were discussing right now with Tianxia. But could you tell us more about this?
Yeah, so well, the conclusion is really short. And, you know, I just wanted to say a little bit about, you know, how do we understand the present? You know, and I was thinking about Back to the Future narratives. And I thought in some ways, you know, Xi Jinping is also dealing with some kind of, you know, he's always talking about Confucius and so on. You know, sometimes he's talking about Marx, but sometimes Confucius, he's sort of bringing them back. And I thought, yeah, well, yeah, I just wanted to share some initial thoughts about his Back to the Future narrative and what are the possibilities, you know. And I thought, yeah, well, one thing that I noticed is, you know, he's going in two directions. On the one hand, it's all about technology and technological development, and on the other hand, realizing some of the communal ideas or whatever of the past. And I thought that one of the things he might need to do is sort of bring these two things together, right? And so I thought at this point, you know, he really might need to think about, you know, some of the Marxist arguments about technological development, you know, relative surplus value, the changing composition of capital, right, where fixed capital constantly increases, right, so you get more and more machinery, but, you know, variable capital or labor begins to decrease. And what Marx in the Grundrisse then says is that, well, that could be a possibility for creating a system beyond capitalism that's not based on the exploitation of proletarian labor. Now, that, of course, might be a somewhat simple narrative, but I think it is something that we need to think about, you know, and maybe modify in some ways. But I think what happens with Xi Jinping sometimes is that it's just these two ideas are there, but they're not really brought together in any way. So we don't get a clear sense of what, you know, what socialism would actually mean for him and so on. So I think that's what I just wanted to sort of point in some directions where one could go and sort of rethink, you know, the idea of a back to the future socialist narrative with understanding some of the contradictions in capitalism and how they could point to another society.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listening to you, I'm just thinking about how, like, this politics of time sort of leads us in so many different directions. Because on the one hand, like, there might be some people who take a Postonian view and they might see any sort of look back at tradition and so on as sort of having this danger of becoming, like, you know, fetishized anti-capitalism or sort of, you know, it being directed in a fascistic direction, whereas there might be others who might see that there being some promise and there being some value in sort of trying to sort of form maybe like a cross-ideological alliance to sort of overcome capitalism or overcome the excesses of capitalism. So, I mean, I think for people who are sort of interested in like issues of contemporary importance and relevance, I think your book sort of points to many different directions. And I guess it's up to the reader to decide where they stand on these issues. So thank you, Viren, for taking so much time from your busy schedule to talk with me today. Before we end, may I ask you what you are working on right now and what's next for you?
Okay, so right now there's a book I'm trying to finish on called Pan-Asianism and the Legacy of the Chinese Revolution. And that should be coming out with the University of Chicago Press sometime next year, you know, maybe I think September or something. And so that's sort of on finishing. And now what I'm thinking, there are a couple of projects I'm involved in next. And I think one of them will be most related to this, and that is maybe trying to think this Tianxia problem through, you know, Japan and China further. You know, and maybe I'll see if, you know, if there's an Indian dimension to this as well. I'll try to, but try to bring that in. But I think that in terms of China and Japan, I mean, I was thinking, you know, the Kyoto school, you know, there are two Kyoto schools, right, in Japan, and people sometimes get confused about them, or the two don't talk much. And that is the Kyoto School of Philosophy and the Kyoto School of Sinology. And they're writing around the same time. And both of them in some way or the other are interested in an East Asian alternative or an East Asian world. And I think the Kyoto School of Philosophy, and the, specifically people like Koyama Iwao and Kosaka Masaaki, are both very interested in this kind of world philosophy or world history kind of perspective. And here, of course, Hegel is in the background again. And so I was thinking about looking at them in and looking at how they're, again, in the 30s and 40s, trying to come up with this idea of a new world order and all of this kind of thing. And then trying to then maybe go further into the Chinese Tianxia experience as well. I mean, I've looked at Zhao Tingyang, but there are a number of other Tianxia theorists. And I'm trying to see, well, what do they really have to say about these, you know, this problem of global governance? I mean, if we look beyond Zhao Tingyang, who's maybe the most famous, you know, what are some of the other ways in which they're thinking about global governance and, you know, maybe even a historical narrative towards a new type of globality? So that's, yeah, one project that I'm sort of thinking of working on.
Thank you. I hope our audience continues following your work, and we look forward to reading it. So I also hope our audience reads the book that we talked about today, which is The Politics of Time in China and Japan, Back to the Future, which was published by Professor Viren Murthy, whom I spoke to today, by Routledge in 2022. So thank you, Viren.
Thank you.